I see some smiling in the back because they seen us kind of get hammered at the board meeting. So appreciate everyone's effort to be here tonight. Just a little bit on RAC procedure. We'll go through each of the informational and action items, and if you have comments up front, there's a yellow card. If you'd put your name and what topic that you would like to speak on, if you would give it to a division employee or Chris right here, we'll when it comes to comments, we will call your name and have you speak at the microphone at the front right there, and the division employee will be at this microphone, and they will do their best to answer your questions. With that, I'll start with a wildlife board update. We had the wildlife board meeting on December 1st, and the director gave an update, and he gave a lot of updates, and I thought it was very informational, and I'd like to share some of those with you. On the Colorado River, the bony tail and the razorback sucker that are T&E species, he talked about how they'd gone from very few fish to hundreds of fish. It's kind of a really neat story. In March, there's going to be an aquatic seminar for not only the Wildlife Board members, but it will also be for RAC members. So I think we'll look for more information as it comes out. We can maybe send an email.
Yeah, I'm a PowerPoint.
Awesome. Okay. He also mentioned that the Utah prairie dog, that there was a decision made that put prairie dogs on state land back in the hands of the state to manage those on private lands for the state to manage those. And that's a really big decision. In some of their discussion, sounds like it's kind of maybe the first time some of that's been done. So the director just said that the state wants to work really hard to show the Fish and Wildlife Service that they can manage those, that they have people on the ground and the knowledge to be able to manage T&E species very well. So he committed the state to work hard to do that on those private lands. He mentioned that there's bighorn sheep transplants all over the state from Nevada and Zion. There's been close to 150 sheep transplanted. He also mentioned that there's going to be a pronghorn transplant on the Parker on December 16th. He wanted to invite any and all who would like to come to that. And I think, will you cover that?
Yep.
Okay. He gave an update on wolves. He said that there was been a collared wolf on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. It was a collared female, and it's been a much interest because they did a DNA test on fecal material, and it is a northern wolf. So they've been in talks with Fish and Wildlife Service. They haven't done anything with it yet. They also said that there's one in northern Utah, and they also have a photo of one that they've tried to find more out about, but near Cedar City. And then he went on to talk about some of the local things like the pheasant hunt and the goose and duck hunt, but I'll leave it at that. And then also just to mention the way that the Wildlife Board voted, one of the big things from our last meeting was there was a lot of discussion on the preference points and how to do that. I'd mentioned to the Wildlife Board of any of the topics, that was probably one that we, even though we didn't have a quorum, we had quite a bit of discussion on. And the Wildlife Board decided to stay the same as we are right now, and asked the division to take all of the comments that came through the RAC process, and if they wanted to make a change, that take all of that into consideration, and maybe they would come back. But now that the mule deer plan is in place, there might be some things they take out of that. So another of the things was the moose on the manti and on the sand pitch will be included on the Wasatch hunt now as well. Those areas will be included. There will also be a split season on the sheep for the 9 mile range creek. So that the season dates will be split into two seasons with an overlap in the middle. So, any questions? With that, we'll have a regional update.
Good evening, and thank you for coming tonight. It's good to see a full quorum. Gonna start with some of the things that we're doing. I had hoped to show you our new app. I mentioned it last time. I brought all these cords to hook up my cell phone with the projector, and I could show you exactly how the app works. But for some reason, the projector wouldn't read my phone, so I can't do that tonight. Maybe I'll do it the next time. But like I mentioned last time, we do have a new app. It's free. You can download it on iTunes or whatever the other store is that Android users use. But it has all kinds of information. One of the coolest features is that you can download your license to your phone, specifically your combination license or your fishing license. And so if you're out fishing and a CO asks you to see your license, you can pull out your phone and all the information is there. So that's pretty cool. And there's species identification information. There's information that links you to our mobile website that you can look at WMAs and walk-in access areas, our regulations. There's just a bunch of information on our app. I encourage you to download it and give it a try. Just this last weekend, we were involved in the Helper Light Parade. That's a big event in Carbon County. We had a float. That middle picture there is kind of us in our shop there preparing the float. But we did an aquatics-themed float. Our law enforcement section kind of took the lead on that, but it was a fun event and represented the division and got involved in our community. Kevin mentioned a meeting coming up in March for all RAC and board members. That's that first line up there. It'll be March 19th at the Central Regional Office Conference Room. That's in Springville. The idea is to give you teach the board members and RAC members about aquatics issues, including hatcheries and how they work and fishing regulations and everything that you might need to know in order to be a knowledgeable RAC member and board member to make decisions and vote on things. Things got cold and then things warmed up, but I believe there's still ice on Schofield and ice fishing is still happening. Hopefully it continues to get a little colder up there and the ice is continue to be good for our tournament on the 7th. Is it the 17th or is it 27th? It's the 27th. We have we're teaming up with state parks and having an ice fishing tournament on the 27th at Schofield. Brent and Walt have been busy leading our conservation outreach efforts. We had a bighorn sheep watch here in Green River on Saturday. It's an annual event that we've had for years and years, and we get a big turnout. We get people from all over the state, the Wasatch Front, local sportsmen and wildlife conservationists and viewers and watchers. They come to this event, and the sheep weren't cooperating quite as much as they have in the past. I think the next year we might do it a week early. They did see sheep, but they were pretty far away, and you needed a scope to see them. So usually we're closer to them, and picture taken is much better. But it was still a successful event. 90 people came. They got to learn about bighorn sheep and bighorn sheep management. This Saturday, Walt and his new recreation program will team up with the Blanding Gun Club and have a three-gun shoot in Blanding. And then later this month on the 20th, our extensive species biologist, Tony Wright, will team up with Brent and the Moab Bird Club and do a Christmas bird count in the Moab area. The habitat section's wrapping up a lot of their habitat projects. I mentioned the last meeting, our habitat section does some amazing work. They restore watersheds and habitats, everything from lowland riparian areas to mid-elevation winter ranges to high-elevation summer ranges, and does aspen work and everything in between to benefit species that we hunt and species that we don't hunt. And a lot of these projects benefit dozens of species. Here's some projects that were listed on the slide here. Nicole Nielsen, our habitat restoration biologist, she's here tonight. She's on the agenda. I think she's one of the last items, but she's going to give a 10-minute presentation recap on some of the projects that are happening in this region. And then our law enforcement section, of course, is actively pursuing leads and checking hunters, and specifically this month, they're doing what they call a saturation patrol. So there'll be several times this month where they all team up together and go out on the winter ranges together and look for violators and poachers and let the public know that their presence is year-round and they're protecting the wildlife resources that we all value so much. And our wildlife section is busy as well. They're doing deer classifications. They're continuing to collar deer on the San Juan and the Manti as part of a survival study that's been ongoing for several years. So they'll continue to collar some more deer this year. Kevin mentioned we have a pronghorn capture, and I sent an email out to all the RAC members inviting you to participate in this event. I realize it's on a work day, and most of you or all of you have jobs, and it's hard for you to get away and participate. But if you're interested, let me know. I need to know sooner rather than later, though, so we can accommodate you and buy enough food for you. But we'd love to have you. It's next week. Monday night we'll meet in Torrey and have a meeting, a safety meeting, and then Tuesday, first thing, we'll start with the capture and trap. And so it's a great opportunity to get hands-on experience with antelope. So I think we're capturing 350 pronghorn, and I can't remember how many, 50 or 100 of those, one of the two, will come to Hatch Point. So hey, there's a...
Chris, a question on that is, you said that you'd meet on Monday, but the 17th and 8th are Tuesday and Wednesday. Are those dates right, or is it the 16th and 17th?
It's the 16th and 17th. Well, I think it's the 16th, 17th, and 18th, I think, is what it is. But so for sure, you need to be there on the 16th in the evening to be briefed. Okay. And then I think most we're going to be working on the 17th all day. I think a lot of our VIP guests, which would be included all of you, would go home that evening on the 17th.
But Monday night would be the 16th. Training to get trained up.
Correct. Okay. Yep, thanks for that. And then we're going to continue to do some bighorn sheep captures for our telemetry study, and then we'll be starting our elk flights in January, looking at the South Book Cliffs units. And then as deer become problematic in communities and urban areas, and we will continue to transplant deer from those areas to units in our region. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Any questions from the RAC?
Okay. I just have one more thing. Commissioner Horrocks has been a great RAC member for a lot of years. He's no longer commissioner. I guess that's you finish out the rest of this month, and then some new commissioners are coming in. But we'd like to thank Jeff for his work on the RAC. He's been our elected representative for this RAC and has done a great job, and we appreciate his diligence and his hard work in representing those he represented. And I have a print for you here.
lots of help. So to thank him for his service, hope you have a wall for this in your house somewhere. We have an office. But we'd like to thank you for your service, and you deserve a ton of our appreciation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For his time, many times as a elected official, there could be a lot of things on your plate, but I appreciate Jeff's effort in working with wildlife and understanding the issues from the community. And many times he presented or represented the public very well, and so I thank him for that service. Thank you. Now with that, one thing that I forgot. We need approval of agenda and minutes. So I would entertain a motion to that.
Well, looking at the agenda and reviewing the minutes, I would make a motion that we accept the minutes that was presented for the meeting last RAC meeting we had, and also the approval of the agenda.
You want to amend that to the last two? Meetings. We didn't have a quorum to approve them.
Okay. I would amend that motion to include the minutes from the last two meetings to approve those, and then also the agenda for this meeting.
Okay. Thank you. So
I'll second that.
Okay. So just to repeat that, we've got a motion by Carl Ivory to approve the minutes of the last two meetings and also the agenda, and seconded by Darris Jones. All in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. All right, with that, we'll go to action item with Drew Cushing. Or Justin Hart.
I'm Justin Hart. I'm the aquatics manager for the Southeast Region in Price, and I'm presenting this on behalf of Drew Cushing, our warm water coordinator in Salt Lake. So we're proposing some minor changes to our private pond rule. This is the stocking of private waters in Utah. The purpose of this rule is essentially provides private fish growers and private pond owners instructions on what species of privately grown fish they may stock, whether or not fish stocked in private ponds need to be sterile, or whether or not they can be fertile. And it defines what the responsibilities of the private pond owners and the private fish growers are. The purpose of this rule change is essentially to make it a little easier for the private pond owners and also for our growers. Currently, a pond owner may not pick up and transport fish on their own without having a COR, a certificate of registration for their pond. Getting a COR is, I guess, perceived difficult. It is time consuming. It takes 30 to 45 days typically, and it's fairly expensive. There's a modest cost in getting a COR. So the change we'd like to propose is that private pond owners may transport their own fish privately that they purchase from a certified grower without a COR, assuming a couple stipulations. And those stipulations would be that they're transporting a small amount of fish, less than 50 pounds, that they're transporting sterile rainbow trout only. There are a few places in the state where even sterile fish are not allowed to be stocked, and I think primarily those are down in Washington County, but that rule does exist. And then also they need to sign a formal affidavit or a contract that basically lays out the responsibilities and penalties for not living up to the responsibilities of transporting fish within the state. And this is something I understand is going to be probably put on our website and also available at our office for those people, and the fish growers, I'm sure, will have copies as well.
That's essentially
it. So I think this will probably help the private fish growers sell more fish, make it a little bit easier for the private landowners, and you know, we support it. It's supported by the growers, and I think by Senator Noel.
Uh, questions from the rack?
I have one. It's just technical. It has to do with the, oops, I've lost it now. So the language on the second page and about halfway down or a little better, you've got a piece that's lined out and it's identical to the next line or next section, which is section H.
You're talking about the rule?
Yes. So that's, I mean, that's one of the changes. And it kind of, it, you know, kind of what puzzles me is it doesn't make much sense because it's talking about a subsection H, but there doesn't seem, that doesn't seem, I can't follow, oh, there's a G way up there. But then there's a B, you know, and then there's I, and then, you know, it's just kind of hard to follow that. I don't know if there's something wrong with me. I don't know. But it does look hard to follow.
Okay. Well, I don't understand specifically what you're...
Oh, it's just using the way it's just, I mean, I guess if I look real hard, I can see something, but it, to me, it just looks like all of a sudden this... Never mind. You know, it's just weird. I think it's probably right. It's just hard to follow why that is.
Any other questions? Questions from the audience? Just a reminder, we don't have any comments on this action item, but if you would like to make a comment, up front there's a yellow card like Chris has here in his hand. If you will fill that out and hand that to him at the time of comments, we'll call your name and have you come up and present on that microphone in front. Any comments from the rack? Motion by Jeff Horrocks to accept Rule R657-59 as presented by the division. Do we have a second?
Okay.
Okay. Seconded by Chris Mikos. All in favor? Opposed? Unanimous. All right, with that, we'll go to action item number 6, Leslie McFarland.
I'm going to apologize up front. I'm fighting a cold, and last night I kept hacking away while I was trying to talk, so I'm going to apologize up front. I'll try not to do that to you. So I want to give you a little bit of history, because I think it's been a little bit of time since you guys have reviewed or gone through their recommendations. We do have a 12-year management plan that went through the public process and was approved in 2011. The plan was assembled and recommended by the Utah Black Bear Advisory Committee, which consisted of representatives from the following groups that are listed up on the slide. The plan requires that we recommend permits for a 3-year period, so over the period of 12 years, we should come before the RAC and the board 4 times. So all of the permit numbers that we're recommending tonight are in accordance with the guidelines and objectives of our current black bear management plan. And the permit numbers will be split between several different seasons. One of the objectives in the plan does require us to evaluate the spring season and look at ways to reduce depredation and nuisance take by the division. And so I'll go into that a little bit later, but there are some season change recommendations to meet that objective. So our plan goal overall is to maintain a healthy bear population in existing occupied habitat and to expand distribution while considering human safety, nuisance problems, livestock and depredation concerns, habitat limitations, and possible impacts on other wildlife species. In our plan, we define a healthy bear population as one that has a proportion of breeding age animals that will maintain population levels consistent with habitat requirements, and we look to maintain genetic variability. Our plan, like I said, does ask us to try and maintain a stable bear population while considering other wildlife populations, the level of human-bear conflict that occurs, and general population dynamics. Within the plan, we have three different strategies that we can use to harvest bears on each of our units. So all of our units fall under one of these strategies. A light strategy is one where there's little to no human-bear conflicts and one where we manage for older age males in our population. But in order to select this strategy, you have to have little to no human-bear conflicts. A moderate harvest strategy is one. This is where most of our bear units within the state fall under. It's where we have moderate levels of human-bear conflict, and we try and have at least 30 to 40% of the harvest consisting of females to help control populations. And we want adult males to make a greater than 5 years old to make up about 25 to 35% of the harvest that we see every year. And then a liberal strategy, there's only 5 units in our state that fall under that. It's where human-bear conflicts and take by wildlife services in the division exceed sport harvest take. It's one where we're trying to reduce populations to eliminate conflicts. In these populations, we like to see younger age males, and we like our harvest to consist of about 40 to 45% females. So bears are a very long-lived species, and so we've got some really good population data that we can rely on to try and estimate our populations. They aren't like deer or elk where you can go out and count them every year. So what we do is we require that hunters bring their harvested bear in and we remove a tooth. And so all of the bears that are harvested in our state, we get sex and age information off of them. We can take the known ages from the tooth and our harvest, and we can go and we can reconstruct the population backwards. And so based on the ages that we see within our harvest, we can determine what kind of population we'd have in order to see the age structure that we're seeing in our harvest. And so based on that, we also can get a population growth rate. So from our data that we're collecting every year on our bears, we can determine that we're seeing an increase in populations about 5 to 6% annually, and we've probably got about 1,500 adult male bears in our population currently. If male-to-female ratios were 1-to-1, which we know they aren't because we select for males in our harvest and we know we have more females, you would have at least 3,000 adult male and female bears. So we know that it's probably likely higher than that, but this also doesn't account for cubs or yearlings. So we estimate that we have at least 4,100 bears in our state. The last population of density abundance estimate in 2009 estimated about 3,500. So I'll just explain this graph a little bit. The line with the triangles are the number of permits that we issue per year. You can see that in 2011, with the implementation of this plan, we had quite a jump in the number of permits that were issued. The thing that you have to remember is that those were 95 spot and stock permits, which are a very low harvest success type permit. So although we increased by a lot of permits, harvest did not increase tremendously. If you look down below, the light gray bar is our sport harvest take, and we're averaging this last year about 270 bears that were taken on sport harvest. The dark gray part of the bar is the number of bears that were taken by Wildlife Services and our agency because of human safety concerns, livestock depredation, or nuisance problems. We typically will average about 50 to 56 bears that are taken for this reason. This last year we had 81. Typically our agency only accounts for about 6 to 7 of those. Our agency had to remove 32 bears this past year. So we're looking, so you can see that although we increase the number of permits, it may have to do more with timing and how we harvest bears in order to increase our success. So we're looking at trying to do some different things with the season in order to increase harvest, reduce the number of bears that our agency takes, and try and use hunters to do that. So our first proposed change, our agency does receive a lot of conflict calls in the spring season. And most of the calls had to do with people that had set up bait stations and they had consistently been working it and then accidentally, or some have been accused of doing it on purpose, hounds will run through. And it's hard to not set hounds on something, and if you have a bait station, not to run through that area. So we're trying to look at ways to eliminate these conflicts. And so one of the proposed ways that we came up with was to try and use the spring season and allow hound hunting, and then use a summer season that would use baiting to try and increase harvest in these different seasons but eliminate that conflict. So the spring limited entry hunt, we would not allow baiting. We would allow hounds or spot and stock, and we are adding 1 week to the end of the season to address access issues that occur earlier with this, like April 4th. A lot of times you have snow and gates are closed, and so we added a week onto the end of the season to try and account for the inaccessibility. So then the new season would be a summer limited entry. During this time period, we would not allow hounds. The thought behind this is to try and change the timing of harvest to help eliminate control and help control nuisance or depredation problems. We also would allow harvest with any legal weapon. Previously over bait, we only allowed archery tackle. We believe that this will open up bear hunting and provide opportunities for different type of sportsmen. So typically if you hunt over bait, you had to be able to use archery equipment, or you had to use hounds. During this time period, we would not allow hounds because of concerns for fawning and calving. Also during this period, you have more female bears with cubs that are active. We would allow bait hunters to begin. Sorry, I'm going to cough on you. So we would allow bait hunters to begin baiting 1 week prior to the opening of the season, so beginning May 30th, but we wouldn't want them to start hunting until June 6th, so we didn't have conflicts.
Say that again, when they could start baiting?
They could start baiting May 30th, but they couldn't, so that they could have a period to try and get bears into the baiting stations, but they couldn't really start hunting until June 6th.
And when does the other hunt end?
The other hunt ends June 5th. So there's a one-week period where you'd have possible baits, but if it does take bears a time to get accustomed to baits, so we don't think we'd have hounds running off of baits, which is illegal. So our harvest objective seasons, these are primarily on units where we are trying to reduce bear populations to address conflict issues. The 9 Mile unit, Wasatch Mountain West in the central region, those are the primary units where we use this. In this season, unlimited permits are sold, and the unit closes when the quota is met or the season ends. And each region, like, I have some slides that show each region what it recommends, so you can see where those are. We are proposing one other new season. This would be only on the Book Cliffs unit. This is to try and see if we can keep harvest without impacting archery big game hunts that are also occurring during the same time. So this season would begin August 10th, would go to September 11th, which is the end of the limited entry archery elk hunt. You could use archery, tackle, and bait only, and it would be the entire Book Cliffs. And you could do a bait station or spot and stock. There's no real changes suggested for fall limited entry. The one exception, which I'm sure will be brought up here tonight, would be the LaSalle and the San Juan unit, which has shortened dates to try and address conflicts between different hunt types. And then the Book Cliffs, Bitter Creek, there are some different season dates there. We do have a limited entry spot and stock season proposed on the LaSalle and San Juan units that would go through the month of October, as well as on the Book Cliffs, Little Creek, Roadless. The limited entry multi-season was previously known as a premium permit. We're changing the name to multi-season to mirror big game, which recently also made the switch to multi-season. If you draw one of these permits, you can hunt any of the seasons approved for the unit that the permit is authorized for. You must use the appropriate weapon type and method authorized for the season being hunted, and it cannot be used during harvest objective or pursuit seasons. So I won't go through each of these individually, but if you look at the, unless you have specific questions about another region, if you look at the column, spring limited entry with no bait is the first column. Spring limited entry, no hounds, is the second. Fall limited entry is the middle. Multi-season permits are the the fourth. The yellow column are the total number of permits for that area. And the right column is the number of permits that we're increasing to address issues. If you look through these where it says quota, those are harvest objective hunts during that season time frame, or spot and stock during that season time frame. Central region, like I said, Wasatch Mountains West, we had a lot of livestock depredation problems this past year there, as well as a lot of human conflict issues, so that unit did increase quite a bit. And I'm going to let Guy kind of give you the regional recommendations here.
You're going down.
Going down.
On the units in our region, most of them are going to have an increase in permits, some more than the others. On the Manti units, on the variables that we talked about in terms of males, adult males and females. One of the criteria was in and one was out, so it's a fairly modest increase on the Manti units. Permit numbers are pretty close to what they were last year. We'll have the additional summer hunt on each of those units, and you can see there what the numbers are. On the 9-mile unit, it's going to go from a limited entry in the spring hunt to a harvest quota or harvest objective, and it'll have a quota of 15 bears. And the quota was based on the average that it had over the past years, is what the quota is based on, the average harvest. It'll have the summer hunt as well. The fall hunt is pretty similar to what it was previously. And the difference in the fall hunt will be that the quota for the fall spot and stock won't be included with the fall hunt. So that's a separate quota of 10. So that's an addition on that unit as well. On the La Salle's and the San Juan, those units will both have increase. Primarily the increase will be in the spot and stock, but there will be some increase probably in harvest in the other hunt. We typically harvest about 30 bears, 30 to 35 bears on those two units, and we anticipate with the changes in this, the spot and stock and the permit changes, that we'll probably harvest around 40 to 45 bears on those two units. I think that's it.
So one thing that I think is important to mention, when you look at the permit split between the spring and the summer seasons, the way that we figured out the summer seasons is we took the spring hunts for the previous 3 years and we looked at the number of bait CORs that were applied for in those areas. And we tried not to increase that dramatically in all of those areas, because one thing that we don't know is how successful any weapon over bait is going to be. So we don't want to increase it too drastically that we really affect the bear population all at once. So we really want to take this year to evaluate how that harvest and really affects what we do. And so we've got limited numbers of permits, but we're willing to look at it in the future based on what the success is, what we do in the future with numbers of permits for that season. The southern region, you can kind of see their breakouts. They didn't really have a whole lot of bear issues in their region, except for on the beaver, where they did increase by 5 permits because they had a lot of campground bear conflicts this past summer. But other than that, they didn't increase a whole lot. So one thing that we want to do, because we don't know what the success rate will be with any weapon over bait hunt, and we didn't want it. We want to increase harvest, but we didn't want to do it too drastically. Our typical average statewide success rate is between 42 to 45%. That also varies by the type of hunt that you do. So if you're a bait hunter, it's usually around 47%. Hounds are about 45%. And then the fall spot and stock hunters are about 17 to 20%, which is actually quite high when you look at other states. It's usually about only 12%. We want to see our harvest from 270 sport harvested bears that we took this last year. We want to see it increase at least by 20%. So we expect to see a harvest of 300 to 320 bears. If we exceed that by more than 20% in this year, we want to be able to come back next year and make some changes and adjustments so that we don't hit our bear populations too hard. We are concerned about what we do to the resource. We want to try and manage it, but we don't want to go overboard. There is one boundary change. This comes from this region. The San Rafael North is currently not a bear management unit, but occasionally bears wander down out of the Central Mountains Manti South unit and get into trouble. We want to be able to use hunters off of the Central Mountains Manti North and be able to call them to come and help address some of these problems when we have them. So we're asking to expand the boundary over into the San Rafael so that we can use those hunters when we need to. There are no real changes to the dates that we're recommending for general pursuit. These will be standard with the dates that they've been in the past. Restricted pursuit, it does affect this region and the northeastern region primarily, just because of the pressure that these units receive from houndsmen on pursuit seasons. So we are recommending numbers consistent with last year. We do have a change to our rule to try and address some bear crop depredation issues that we have, and this is primarily in this region, and it primarily has to do with commercial melon crops. Bears like melons. and so we're changing the rule to allow us the ability to issue a control permit or as many as we need to address issues in commercial cultivated crops that are established for a profit. They have to be a minimum of 5 acres of privately owned land enrolled in Greenbelt. They have to demonstrate chronic bear damage currently occurring, or they have to have a history of chronic bear damage. The regional office will be able to issue those control permits to a landowner, immediate family member, or employees to help remove these problem bears. The crop owner must immediately notify us after a bear is killed. One other change that we're requesting, currently our rule requires that anyone that is successful in drawing a permit or purchases a harvest objective permit that they have to complete an orientation course before they can receive that permit. We do have problems trying to get these hunters to complete the course after they successfully draw. It's resulted in people missing out on their bear hunting opportunity. So rather than have us spend hours trying to get people to complete the course, we're asking that everyone that applies for a bear permit be required to take the mandatory educational course on an annual basis. The course will be modified annually, and it will be used as an educational tool for bear identification, population management, and ethics. And then there are just some other housekeeping modifications to the rule. We're modifying it to allow crossbow use that was previously approved. Changing the name from premium permit to multi-season, and then changes to allow for the crop depredation control permits. We're also shortening the waiting period from 7 days to 3 days for when you purchase a harvest objective permit, and allowing any weapon to be used over bait. And that's it.
All right. Thank you. That's quite the picture, Guy. With that, any questions from the rack?
I have a question. This may sound silly, but I'm just wondering if there's anything that we can learn from bears and how we manage them. They've increased quite rapidly. If there's anything we can learn from that and apply it to deer so that we could grow deer as fast as we're growing bears.
Yeah, sorry, I'm gonna throw. Choke. I got a few to ask you here. I'm gonna throw at you here. Is my concern looking at it? If you have the San Juan's a draw, the La Salle's a draw, and the Book Cliffs is a harvest objective, and you had how many applicants trying to draw Book Cliff tags last year? Around 900, I believe. But the worry I have is I see the need to increase the bear take. But you have these people that apply those two units. They can't do those units, but they can buy a tag and go to the Book Cliffs. Have you got any idea of the pressure you're going to have from out-of-state guides, people, how many people is going to be on the book cliffs and the conflicts you're going to have? It's going to be tremendous.
Yeah, we are concerned about that.
And
but based on the history from the Cougar, and Guy will have to help me on this, did you guys see a lot of conflicts on the book cliffs under the Cougar Harvest objective?
That's apples and oranges. You don't have the access you have or the numbers of people that you're going to have on this bear thing. And I think you're going to have a public relations nightmare that's going to bite you on this one. I don't see any way out. You're creating a bad sinkhole here. I'm not saying you don't need to take more bears. I just see this as a bad, bad way to do it.
So the one thing that has come up in all of the other racks was concern over the harvest objective. There is a request on here by the sportsmen's groups for us to do a change to that. We're going to need some time in order to put something together. So if it's not going to work, then what we would recommend is that rather than... Because the request that's put on the proposal that you'll hear about in a little bit does create some issues for us when we start treating non-residents differently than residents. We do have some past history with being sued over that.
From a law enforcement standpoint, I don't think you can.
Right. And so rather, if harvest objective is really going to cause that problem, we would like a year to evaluate a way to implement that, and rather than cause the issue this year, we'd be willing to make it limited entry, double the number of permits, and split it 90-10 so that we can try and get the harvest that we need off of there. I mean, harvest objective on the 9 mile, it will cause issues because you've got a lot of private land there.
Well, access is restricted, and it's a whole different ballgame over
right
there.
So, I mean, it may work on the 9 mile, but if it wouldn't work on the book cliffs, that's what we'd want to go to until we could evaluate and implement something different.
Hey, Leslie. Yes. I was going to say, too, you brought that up, but having the 9 mile goal harvest objective may take some of that pressure off.
There's not the access over there.
Right.
I don't think so.
And that's the concern over there is there is a concern if we put limited entry double permits that we won't get the access because it's private land.
And so
we'd rather keep that one harvest objective, but if the book cliffs is going to be that, we'd rather turn it back to limited entry and double the permits.
Yeah, and then you also have the people that have put in for 10 years and now that's gone on the book cliffs.
We recognize that, but we've got to do something with the bear population. We have to do something. It's a management issue more than it is concern over how many years they put in to try and draw out.
Yeah, you're going to take a hit.
Any other questions from the rack, Darius?
Yes, I have a few.
Okay. Yeah, Darius, and then Wayne.
Following up on Daryl's comments and your concern about the population on the book list, how many bears were relocated to the book list last year?
They don't do that.
Oh, yeah, they do. I met Mr. Wallace one day letting one go.
Did you guys move any? Did we move any from the south to the book cliffs?
One.
Okay, so that makes 3 total this year. In most years, it's a bit more than that, but this year it was 3. Most bears, problem bears, died this year. Very few of them were moved.
Go ahead, Wayne.
I always have concerns about population estimates. I think it's pretty coarse way of estimating them. I don't doubt that there's a good, healthy population of bears, but I oftentimes am not sure I would agree how great that growth is. So I'm not really worried about bear hunting per se, but in a in the book list right now, I think we're seeing also a different kind of problem. There's a whole lot more activity going on up there, especially once you get up into the Rhone Cliffs and beyond, where there's a lot of oil and gas development. But we're even seeing it right here in the, you know, right along the border with Grand County, and we'll see even more as there's an even greater extension towards the roadless area up there. So I think part of the problem with the bears is not just bears, but it's people. So I don't really know how you solve that, but I'm not sure about killing more bears as being the way to go about doing that.
So I understand your concern over the estimates. But the way that we used it is a popular way. I mean, it's been used for over half of a century on bear population estimates. And so we feel pretty confident using our age data. I mean, we've got really good age data. Every bear has to be turned in. And for it could be as high as 6,000. What we're saying is it's a minimum of 4,100. The other thing that I didn't mention when I talked about the status of bears in Utah, each one of our regional offices has female bears that are radio collared. Every year we go into those dens and we look at the number of cubs that they have. If over a 5-year period, and this is within our management plan, if over a 5-year period you go in and out of 2 of those 5 years they have yearling cubs present with them, that's considered population growth and recruitment. And so that did occur this last 5-year period. We did see that increase.
Well, I mean, I agree that maybe it's a good model. Maybe it would be better if there were some way of being more precise about those populations and where they are.
It's hard with the predators.
But still, yeah. It doesn't mean that there's any reason to believe the bear population is not in good shape. I don't. Right. That's not, but yeah. So you know, trying to use a method like these hunting methods to control a population that is an estimate is just something I'm not really going to vote in favor of. And the other piece is, of course, that I object to both bait hunting and pursuit with kill hunting. I think that those are both unethical. We would probably be fining people and putting people in prison if they were to hunt deer or elk like that. And so I'm not going to vote for this.
Just a reminder, we are in the questionable period.
Yes.
Chris?
Leslie, the online, anyway, the course, the orientation course, is it online or do they have to come into one of the regional
It's
offices?
Online. It's okay. Online, and then it's connected to their customer ID, you know, how you buy your licenses. So once they complete that, it would allow them to go through and apply or purchase a permit.
Okay.
So just to verify, this plan that if you put into place this year, you originally said 3 years, but then are you going to evaluate that? Okay.
Yeah, we wanted to put a safety valve in there because we're actually not sure how this summer limited entry season, how successful it will really be. And so we didn't want to just say, okay, 3 years and we're locked into it. We wanted a safety net.
I got a question on your. I'm glad to see you finally got a depredation program for some of these guys around here for their crops. That's good. My question is it a commercial crop? So do you have a limit, or do they have to produce so much dollar-wise, or what's your requirement?
No, we just mostly it was written for the melon situation down here.
Okay.
But when we write this, it actually goes statewide. And so we had to try and evaluate. I mean, you start delving into things like beehives and all of that type of thing. And so the way that we defined it was a commercial crop that they're doing it for a profit, so that we didn't get sucked into trying to compensate for backyard beehives and
orchards and things of that nature.
Because, I mean, there are some situations in some of the other regions where you have a backyard apple tree or something, and they do come in to those occasionally. And we didn't want to, I mean, that falls more to us to do. We didn't want to be having to issue permits for a backyard apple tree.
Okay. Thank you.
And that one more question. So you, with the baits, where you do permit, you know, baiting for a week prior to the hunt, do you have any requirements about what happens with that bait station once that hunter has?
Yeah, within 72 hours, it has to be completely cleaned up. And they can't just leave
it. Maybe I thought at one time the Forest Service required a permit to establish a bait station on a national forest.
So our rule requires that they get permission from the land managing agency, and they're allowed two baiting stations.
Yeah, so they do have to get approval process through the land management agency. We do have a location of where that is, and if it wasn't cleaned up, we have a location of who that hunter is. So we can work with the division to take appropriate action.
You said something about if you didn't do the harvest objective on the book cliffs, you'd do a limit entry. Now, you was going kind of fast. Did you double the numbers when you said that?
So when we put a quota out there, that's the number of permits that we want. That's the number of bears that we want to have removed. If you consider that you're 47% successful, so about half of the permits are successful, you'd have to double the quota in order to try and get that many killed.
Okay, one more. How many conflict bears were removed from the book cliffs?
I've got that. Just
okay.
Brad's got it.
Just three?
All within 3 miles of right here, basically.
Right here in town, Mellon Bears. Okay, so there wasn't any conflict with livestock or anything on the mountain?
Not that I'm aware of. There's no.
So the Northeastern had some. They had six.
They had six.
They actually had seven. I take that back.
The main conflict's at the sheep. Any other questions from the rack?
On your population increase, I assume it's not consistent statewide. Some units are increasing faster than other units. Other units are stable. Some may be decreasing.
Yeah, so like as you look at this where it says same, those units we didn't have a lot of conflict on. We didn't see a lot of problems, so we kept permits the same as they had been the previous 3 years. The units where we had a lot of livestock conflict, we used the rule to adjust those permits so that we can try and address those issues using sportsmen.
But when you're estimating population increase based on the denning and the harvest,
it was statewide. It's a statewide increase.
It's consistent
increase.
Everywhere.
Yes.
Each unit is increased that amount.
Yes. That was the statewide estimate. It's not by unit.
And that's not an average over the state.
That was taking the actual tooth data, building the population, and then seeing how the population, how the ages are increasing year to year. It's 5 to 6% every year. And so when you look at harvest, we took 330 bears this past year. That's not even close to what we're increasing every year.
Any other questions from the rack before we go to the public? Okay. Comments, please fill out a comment card. We'll go to questions from the audience, please come up to the microphone and state your name. Just for comments.
Got about 3,000. How many conflict calls did you have last year concerning the book cliffs? And how many of them were a result of actually called in, or how many of them were a result of your telephone survey following the conclusion of the hunt? Your conflict calls, you say you get a lot of conflict calls between hounds and things. What's a number? You say it's a lot. What is a lot?
So we are actually going back through the harvest surveys to pull all of those comments so that we can give you a number, because it's come up in several of the RAC meetings that everybody wants to know a number.
Hey, Guy, just so we can capture your comments, will you step to that microphone? Thank you.
The region itself, Guy, I know that the northeastern region, and it's more specifically to do with the North Slope, the South Slope, and all of those units where they have more conflicts than anywhere else. It may not be specifically the Book Cliffs. Are you speaking between the different hunt types, or what are you talking about?
Well,
conflict
you get a lot of conflict calls, and I guess you're pointing at the bait versus hounds.
The bait versus hound thing has been a big conflict call, big conflict between hunting types.
But
and
you don't have a number.
We can work on getting you a number, but I don't have it here.
Can you bring back up your slide to your summer pursuit on LaSalle and San Juan? Can you tell us how many permits were issued on both them units the last several years? You said it was pretty much the same. Can you say what the difference is from four to what it was last year, the year before?
Guy, didn't we keep it the same as what it was last year?
No.
The number of pursuit permits?
The summer pursuit on LaSalle, let's just take that one. For instance, it's a four this year for resident, one non-resident. What was it last year?
It was 13 for the early season and 8 for the late season.
Can you also, under your bear management plan, can you go to what a liberal harvest did? You've talked that you've doubled the permits on the book list. Does your bear management plan allow for you to go more than 50%? Or does it not state right in the management plan that the maximum would be a 50% increase?
No, what the management plan says is that we can increase up to 40%. So we have two things that we can use. If we have a population increase through the bear denning, we can increase it by 20%. Then on top of that, we can increase and adjust based on where the harvest for the previous year falls within. So we can increase up to 40%. Well, what I'm saying here, okay, is we want this number of bears to be harvested. In order for that number of bears to be harvested, if your harvest success is 47%, we'd have to double that number in order to get that many bears harvested if you want to meet the quota.
Okay. I'll just reserve one for comments.
Just to repeat that in the microphone, 13 early and 5 late?
Correct.
Okay. Take additional questions from the audience. Okay, seeing none. Ben Louder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ben Louder, representing the Utah Bowman's Association tonight. I handed out a copy of my recommendations to all of you earlier before the meeting started, so you should have a copy of them if you want to follow along on paper. Last week I met with leaders from three different organizations in addition to mine, Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, the Houndsman Association, and the United Wildlife Cooperative. We met to discuss the division's recommendations, and as we went through them, we discussed things that we liked, things we didn't like, and came up with a joint recommendation concerning them. We support the division's recommendations with four exceptions, and I'll go through these individually and discuss them individually. The first exception is dealing with the summer baiting season. We're concerned that the shortened amount of time on that season is not going to be enough time to be able to successfully bait bears properly during that time. Baiting is a very time-intensive activity, and therefore we are recommending an additional 2 weeks on the front of that season. That would set those dates to May 23rd to July 2nd. We recognize that that would create a two-week overlap between the hound season and the bait season. We believe that that's acceptable, and that with it only being 2 weeks, that, the conflicts would be minimal during that time. And in addition, we believe that this is the absolute best compromise to maximize days in the field for both for both bait hunters and hound hunters. Our second exception is concerning the San Juan and La Salle fall season dates. As has been mentioned here tonight, those dates are different, recommended different than the rest of the fall season dates throughout the state. Those units are very large units, and they have very minimal permits. Each of them only has five permits on them, five bear permits. And we believe there's ample room for both fall bear hunting and limited entry elk hunting to occur at the same time. I can speak to this personally a little bit. San Juan is a premium elk unit. It's also a premium bear unit. I have in my membership, I have elk hunters, I have bear hunters. I cannot tell one of them that their hunt is more important than the other. And I don't believe that we should be giving preference to one hunt over another for a public resource to be pursued on a public resource. And as such, we are recommending that those season dates mirror the rest of the fall season dates. As I mentioned, I can speak to that personally. I've spent 30 days on San Juan during the archery elk hunt the last 2 years. Last year I had the privilege of having a permit. This year I was helping a friend that had the same permit. In those 30 days, I saw hounds and houndsmen twice. Never had any conflicts, never any issues. Nothing but positive experiences. So we believe that those conflicts are minimal. Our third exception is concerning how the tags are allocated between the spring and the summer seasons. We're concerned that with the new season structures that are being recommended, as well as the addition of being able to hunt over bait with any weapon, is going to over time change the demands of bear hunters and which season they would like to be hunting. And to address that, we'd like to see the tag pools combined into one tag pool and have both seasons drawn out of one tag pool. Really, this is simply an extension of what we're already doing. For those that may not be familiar, currently on the spring hunt, there's an any weapon tag and an archery tag. In order to bait right now, you have to have an archery tag. They both are drawn out of the same tag pool. When you put in, you simply specify whether you want an any weapon or an archery permit. So this is really just an extension of that idea. Our final exception is concerning the spring harvest objective units. I failed to see who had that concern earlier, but there was a concern from the RAC earlier, and I appreciate you bringing that up on the demand and the influx that we're going to see from non-residents on those units. I believe that concern is valid. All we have to do is look back to, or really look at the San Juan and La Salle summer pursuit seasons. They are restricted seasons in number of pursuit permits that we currently give, and the reason that those are restricted is because in the past we had a history of an overwhelming influx of non-resident houndsmen coming on those units during the summer to pursue. And so we are concerned about that. As such, we have two recommendations to address that. Our first recommendation would be to leave the spring harvest objective seasons harvest objective for residents and to make them a limited entry hunt for non-residents. I understand that the division has a concern about...
Okay, time.
Am I done?
You can just wrap up.
Okay, sure. We understand that legal concern. We don't believe that, we struggle with that a little bit. If we look at Wyoming and Alaska, they have laws concerning hunting wilderness and certain species that apply to non-residents and that don't apply to residents. And I'll wrap up real quick. The other alternate solution, if we look at our neighbors to the north, Idaho does address this exact situation in their state. The second page of the copy that I handed out to you is a copy of Idaho's hound hunting regulations. They require a hound permit in addition to the bear permit. They are unlimited to residents, and they're limited and by application to non-residents. Thank you very much.
Garrett Call.
Thank you. I'm Garrett Call with Utah Farm Bureau. We are supporting the recommendations. We're excited to see the number of tags go up because we are seeing increased conflicts with bears, with wildlife around the state, and then, you know, more specifically here in Green River is the melons. We shot, I believe, the division shot 13 bears here in Green River this year, just trying to keep them out of the melon fields. And, you know, this is an ongoing problem we've had for years and years. The division did a great job for us this year. They spent a lot of time, a lot of effort to do what they did. But we think there's a simpler way to do that, and that's just let the guys that are already there pull the trigger and take care of the bear when they see it, rather than have to call around and try and round up somebody that can come out there and hope they can get there before the bear wanders off. So we're happy with the help that the division has given us, and we're excited to have this this new approach to try and solve this depredation problem here in the melons. When they first called me and said they're having problems with melons, and they said $20,000, $25,000 worth of melons lost in a summer, I said, you guys are crazy. You know, there's nowhere to eat that many melons. Then I went and walked out through the field, and yeah, they're not lying to you. I mean, those bears will come in and they'll rip the top off a melon, they'll eat the heart out, and they'll go to the next one, and just right down the row, acre after acre of melons lost. So we hope that this new approach will help us solve that problem. So we're supportive of this. Thank you.
Thanks, Garrett. Just a reminder, if you have comments, please fill out a comment card and hand them to Chris here. Frank Darcy.
Hi, I'm Frank Darcy from Moab. Thank you for this opportunity. I'd like to address the LaSalle unit. The bear population has been understated for years, 20 years or more. The population is very healthy and obviously is growing by the amount of conflict that's going on now. My concern with the bears is our deer. The deer herd is undeniably diminishing. Bucks, does, everything. The population is going down. The DWR did a survey in, I think it was 78, where they radio-collared fawns on the fawning ground. The bears are quite clever, and their survey found that the bears found the fawns. They found the fawning grounds, and then they slicked up 80% of the fawns within the first month, with the bulk of the mortality coming within the first week. With an increase in bear population, it's obvious that the deer are going to take it on the chin every spring. So we really support the increase in tags. If there was any way the LaSalle unit could go to a management objective, that would be fully supported as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Any other? Okay, Guy.
I don't know if everybody got this. It was emailed out. One thing you guys might want to do is update your email directory. I know for a fact Meekins is wrong because I checked with him on what his was. Did you get copies? Here it is.
It's Brent's fault.
So I do apologize for that. Wow. I did the best I could with what I had. Guy Webster, local Green River. Got my first hound in 1983. President of Utah Big Game Hound Association, 1992. Been very involved with hounds, bear hunting, lion hunting for obviously a lot of years. Lived in Green River, hunted bears here for close to 25 years here on the Book Cliffs, not missing a year. So I think I got a pretty good feel for what the bear population is, what's going on with hounds, the ups, the downs, and this and that. First of all, this here, the biggest concern we have is going to the harvest objective. For instance, last year there were 903 applicants that put in for bear tags on the Book Cliffs alone. If a mere 10% of those people went to the Book Cliffs, that'd be 93. There was 33 tags last year. Can we imagine what 93 is going to be? We talked about conflicts. 93, if that's 10%, let's say there's 50%. We're looking for 48-hour check-in period, harvest objective of 20. you can easily, very easily, and most likely go over by 10, 15, 20 bears. Not out of line whatsoever. The last 4 years on the book list, the harvest success rate has been 59%. It's not the 40% we're talking. This proposal, what we're asking for, is it goes back to a limited entry. Do agree that there is an increase in bears, and there does need to be some more bears harvested. For instance, if we went back and went to a 35% increase in tax, 30% increase in tax, it would go from, it'd go up to 32 tax, times that by the 59%, you'd have 19 bears. Also, if we included the seasons, being the length of seasons, included you drew a tag, you got to hunt the entire season, hounds would be off the mountain as the DWR's proposal on June 5th. Then it would go to bait only until July 7th as if requested. That success ratio is undoubtedly going to go higher than the 59%. It's going to easily achieve the 20 bears that they're looking to do. Minimize conflicts. The bait guys have still got their time. They can still be spotting stalking from April time period. Gives them more opportunity on the mountain. Can reduce the conflicts. If they have a problem with hounds running off their bait, well, you know what? They still have entire month to bait by themselves. Not going to be a hound on the mountain. The local bear problem here in Green River, yeah, it's a problem. It's been a problem. It's not book flip bears that are coming off the mountain coming into town that's the problem. Haven't been able to run a hound for the last, I think, 4 years now on the roads. There's not been a hound turned loose from probably Nash Wash west towards Green River in the last 4 years. Because if it was, it would be either mine, my son's, or probably Meekum's. That's been taken away from us. Yeah, it is a problem. I've two different times went to try to take care of problem bears in town. Ended up with dead dogs both times because of poison in town. I'm not going to do it no more. It does need to be addressed at a local level, but we don't need to say it's because we got too many on the books. It's just a local bear population problem. I just ask you to take a look at this. Look at the future of hounds. Look at the future of bears. We're not in any disagreement that there are more bears, but let's do this in a sensible fashion. Bear management plan says they cannot double tags. They can go a maximum of 50%. That's right out of the bear management plan that we're talking about in that 12-year plan, page 29, if you want to refer to that. Also, harvest objective units. They are not to be implemented on an area with mainly private or public ground. Bookcliffs has not got much for private ground. Flat says, quota should not be used on units dominated by public land, risk of overshooting, or units with high levels of recreation. Recreation plus oil field work and stuff like that. Bookcliffs isn't subject to quota and stuff. There might be some units, 9 miles is a perfect example of one that is. It's a lot of private ground. It's not public ground. It can fit that criteria. But the Bookcliffs, the South Slope, and the Yellowstone, they don't fit the parameters. We just ask you to remove them from harvest objective. We can still take the bears that need to be taken. We do it in a reasonable fashion. And we can allow those guys that put in anywhere from 11 to 13 years to retain their bonus or preference points and be able to get a quality hunt opportunity and not just an absolute crazed run on it. And you can't compare bears with lions because half of Utah's quota and you're just trying to single out a couple individual units, you put all the pressure there. 903 applicants for only the book list. If son-in-law is a perfect example. He puts in for the San Juan. If he doesn't draw a San Juan tag, he's can't start. He's going to be on the book list. It's going to happen all the time. We could have 900 people on the book list.
I got a question for you, Guy. So I think you give a motion there, but a lot of that was pretty fast. Just give you a chance to restate that motion of what that, based on the percent of harvest on that you were given.
I'm sorry, this was supposed to be attached in the email. I'll just go through it real quick. Bookcliffs spring hunt would be April 4th to July 2nd. Hounds only from April 4th to June 5th. That follows in line with the DWR's recommendations as of right now. Baiting allowed June 6th to July 2nd. Hounds would be off the mountain. Don't have any problem with that. Combine the two tags together. You draw a spring tag, you draw a spring tag. You can hunt any method, both methods, whatever you choose to do. That takes away the problem with non-residents with your legalities of the percentage because they're going to be 10% of the pool. which for instance the book lifts would go to 29 tags. That's a 30% increase from 22 last year. That is actually rounding up their numbers from 30%. Falls right between the 20 and 40% of what their liberal harvest data shows that you should do. Non-residents would go up to 3 from 2, which comes out, you times that by the success ratio on the book cliffs out of their most recent documentation of 59% in the last 4 years. That comes out to 18.88 bears. So you can say 19 bears with the extended season. I undoubtedly know that success ratio is going to climb to 59%, probably into 70, 75%. It's going to allow for them bears to be taken.
Not to exceed 50.
Any other questions? Did that help clarify what years after their
I knew that you had looked at what the harvest was on the book cliffs, and I think that 19, I just wanted you to reiterate that. Thanks.
I just want to clarify really quick for a guy. When the quota is set, when it goes to a quota, it's not set based on the 20, 40, whatever percent. So when I say double, the region that recommended harvest objective set the number of bears that they felt needed to be harvested. So when I said double the number of permits, the region felt that they needed that many bears harvested in order to address the issue. So when I say double the number of permits, it's in order to try and meet what they needed harvested. It's not based on that 40%, because when we do quota, the quota doesn't apply, the 20, 20, 40%. That doesn't apply on quotas.
Thanks, Lester. And any other comments from the audience? Okay. If there's any others while he's coming up, please bring your comment cards up.
My name is Matt McCune. I'm from Moab. I'm not representing anyone other than just sportsmen at this point. I'd like to tell you guys my experience over the last year archery hunting. I had 10 good days on the mountain, and 6 of those days I ran into bears. Ran into them hiking, had bears come in, saw them driving home. I never had a negative conflict with a bear, but at some point it's going to happen. I'm not the only person who's had this experience on the LaSalle unit. My other comment is the deer herd is stressed on that unit. Bears play a direct, they're part of the problem. They may not be the entire problem, but they're definitely affecting the deer population. The bear population is raising 4 to 6%, according to your data, is that correct? 5 to 6. What's happening to the deer population on that mountain? What's the number? Where is it going? You know, we'll just keep that as a rhetorical question. But I'd like to definitely stand up here and say, you need more bears taken off that mountain. You need to have it happen soon. You need to put a dent in that population to help preserve the deer resource. You guys are mandated to protect the deer based on your own slide from the bear population. You guys need to step up and do it, and do it sooner than later. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Cody?
Cody Webster, representing myself. I just would like to say that I would support what the Houndsman Association has put forth in conjunction with the other wildlife groups. I would also like to encourage the division to involve the sportsmen a little bit more when they have all these things that they say, well, we don't know what it's going to do, we don't know how it'll work. Debating with any legal weapon, for example, you want to know how any legal weapon will change it? It won't. I spent 4 summers in Canada. We killed over 140 bears off bait. Any legal weapon doesn't make a difference. If anything, you'll kill less because you'll wound less bears with rifles, because you do have a few that are wounded and not recovered with bows. Thanks.
Thanks, Cody. Any other comments from the audience? Okay. Seeing none, comments from the rack.
I have a few comments. I will agree with a number of individuals in the crowd stating that we should remove the book cliffs from a harvester objective unit. I'm also extremely concerned about our deer population, and we haven't had a study on fawn mortality regarding predators in a while, and it's maybe something we really need to look at, but I just can't see there not being a correlation between the two. And I also would agree with Matt. I also archery hunted quite a bit this fall, and I actually was seeing on average 4 to 5 bears a day. I was on the northern part of the unit, and they say that the bear population is slightly heavier there. So my concern is not so much as, you know, having a direct conflict, but being able to get my kill out if I ever killed something with a bow. Someday it'll happen, but being able to get that out without a conflict at that junction. I do think it's something we really need to look at. And then my only other comment is backing up. Are you guys backing up the archery season even more to August 10th? Is that what you're telling me? Is that what I can see? But it doesn't matter. But pushing that, you guys are killing me. Pushing that spot and stock, and I'm sure there's reasons you have it set. I just think if you push that spot and stock back up into the archery season, allowing archers to feasibly be spotting and stalking, you would raise that take by quite a bit.
I have a couple comments. So I would like to thank the division, because I think a lot of what comes out of the proposal is based off a lot of comments that have come, I think, throughout the state, but a lot of them have come through our RAC. A lot of the gentlemen today have got up and talked about the increased amount of bears that they've seen. And I think that, you know, the division has heard that. I think the proposal is showing that, and it, especially an increase. So I think that it is a step that they've heard the sportsmen and heard the RAC. One of the comments that I have is, to deal with that, through our RAC and then through my work with the Forest Service, I have heard a lot of those conflicts with bear bait stations and houndsmen, just because of my probably where I work, and so I our office receives a lot of those phone calls. I think the division's approach to separate those dates because of those conflicts is a step in the right direction. And I think that the sportsman's proposal from the Bowman's Association, the SFW, of moving those dates together again or overlapping those dates changes that it muddies that whole purpose of splitting those two out to not have that problem. And so I think that the division put a lot of time and effort in to try to separate those two conflicts. The other comment I have is I think one of the biggest reasons that the season dates were changed on the LaSalle's and on the Elk Ridge is because of comments that come through our RAC. If you remember about the last 3 or 4 years, it's very odd that you get an elk hunter that drew in past years that come to a RAC after they had an elk tag, but we had that several times where they had a lot of conflict. And so we may be one of the only regions that heard that, and so maybe some of the other regions don't represent that. But I would just like to reiterate that. I think that the division heard us comment for several years, and I know we didn't. We went through several processes without doing anything before we asked the division to shorten that hunt, and it was because there was a lot of conflict. So I just wanted to bring that up also.
What are you looking at me for? Is it my turn? You know, it's kind of, it's odd. I agree with, mirror a lot of what you're saying too. And the crop damage, that needed to happen a long time ago. Because when I lived here, the melon thing has been going since I had dogs in 1980. And it went on and on and on. And the roadless portion, the roadless is stacked with bears. You got your resident bears that hang in there. And since they disallowed hounds in there, there's a lot of bears in there. And they're not taking the spot and stalk. So I don't know why we're not doing baiting in there, letting the bowmen in there, or the hunters in there. But, you know, it's neither here nor there. The only glaring thing I see is if you do a quote in the book, listen, and I agree, we need to take more bears. I'm not against that, but I don't think you've heard 100th of the complaints and problems you're going to have if you have these hundreds and hundreds of people. The last year before they closed the Book Cliff unit, I was in Cottonwood. I took that bear over there. I shot it that year, and there was probably 30 to 40 camps in those two drainages, people bear hunting, people running up on their four-wheelers, blocking canyons, problems. The division, you don't have enough people to deal with it. And I'm talking to that from a law enforcement standpoint. T.J. Robertson better move soon. Well, that's not yours, is it? So it doesn't work. And I really don't like that. Let's just double it and go, you know. Guys, the numbers and research, I don't have time to go through and figure it out, you know. But that we're just going to do that, double it up and run, I don't like that either. So I really don't know where to go here. How's that? I'm at a loss this time.
That's not what I was expecting.
Yeah.
Now I'm worried. If Daryl doesn't know where to go here, I'm worried.
Is Todd saying anything? You done, Todd?
His microphone's not very loud, I know that.
Well, I tend to pay a lot of attention to what Daryl has to say here in these predator meetings, and so that makes me a little, I don't know, I was feeling pretty good about things, but if he doesn't know where to go here, because I get the... what you're saying about the harvest objective thing. So the doubling thing sounded okay to me, but if you're not sure about that, that makes me wondering.
Well, I kind of agree with Daryl too, or this, because we kind of have this problem back in San Juan County for like deer. We have all these deer hunters, and all these deer hunters run down there, but they got no place to go because either everything's a CWMU or it's a limited entry problem. So you got the front of the blues there that's just swamped, and somebody hunts, you know, there's a constant conflict there. This year I heard of several really bad ones that we had. I don't know if the cops were ever called on any of them. They were threatened to call them, but I think there is a legitimate problem with that because there's a lot of people out there. And as far as these bears on these springs go, I mean, the spring hunt, in my area, we didn't have one houndsman or, you know, people hunting down there. We'd see them every day just gathering our cows in the spring. There were bear everywhere. There'd be three or four bear in each drainage in Montezuma Canyon. They were everywhere. And so I'd call them and I'd say, well, come down, and these bears are here and here. Well, it's too hot down there. I don't know. I don't know if I want to go. I want to go up on the mountain. So that's just experience that I actually had. I tried to call them to have, you know, come down here and look. And it's not private. It was all public lands. But I think there's some. And then like one guy actually told me, well, they're all females, so we don't care about those anyway. And I think that's part of the problem. Everybody's trying to kill a trophy bear, and I understand that, I get that, but I think we got to kill the non-trophies too, or take them out, because I think that's kind of how we run into this problem. I may be completely wrong, but I think that's part of our problem.
Darris?
The way I remember the bear management plan, that the portion about you can't raise it more than 50%. It was kind of a safeguard in there that to prevent overdoing things too fast, and that you could go up to 50% a year, and if things were still looking good, you could raise it another 50% the next year. Now, I may be wrong in my interpretation of that bear plan. And the common ground I'm hearing in this group, with the exception of Wayne, is that we have plenty of bears. We got too many bears in most instances. This proposal, the division proposal, has got a lot of unknowns in it. I mean, nobody really knows how any of it's going to turn out, because none of it's been done. We have no history of some of these new hunts and new things that are being added here. I guess my feeling is until the division has a chance to flesh some of these new proposals out a little more, that maybe we ought to go with simplicity and just add some tags to the existing seasons we have, and not try to reinvent the wheel. Let's just kill some more bears and go unit by unit and figure out, you know, the division has a better idea than anybody on. Sounds like from the proposal that they want to be pretty aggressive with it. So let them get as aggressive as they want, but stay with the management plan under no more than 50% increase per unit in number of tags.
I want to make some comments to that, because I spoke that the division is taking a bold step, and one of those that I know has got a lot of Forest Service employees sitting on the edge of their seat is this June and July hunt, because it's the unknown. And what happens when you have all of those recreationists up on the forest with a new baiting, and what is that unknown? And the division has said, hey, well, let's look at it a year. We're not going to do this three-year process, so if there is a problem, we can adjust it. And so I appreciate that, and I'm just one person, but personally, I'm good with taking the risk of that conflict because of the whole plan, and we're taking a step in the right direction, and we are listening to many of the sportsmen that said, hey, there's a huge increase. So there are a lot of unknowns, but I think the division is doing that because they see a need and they're hearing the concern of many in the public. So there's some risk in it, but they're going to look at it in a year, and that's, to me, what gives comfort also.
So do you have any recommendations for a motion? Darren?
I'd be glad to make one. I don't think it would pass.
We'll ask you to be quiet at this time.
Go ahead, Wayne. Yeah. You know, I voted with you once before.
Once before?
Yeah. I did.
Then the sportsman didn't let him come back for a month.
Yeah, I almost got banned.
Yes.
If comments, I mean, if people feel like they've had their opportunity, I'll make a stab at it. But if discussion, I'd be glad to hold off on a motion.
The only thing that I would bring up is if you want to make a motion, the only thought that of all the things that from the DWR's proposal that I've heard tonight, that I think there is real concern with that quota on the book cliffs. And I think the division has heard that, and one of the things that I really appreciated at the Wildlife Board meeting that I haven't seen done in the past, this last go round, and I probably failed to mention, is after all of the racks, the division took those comments, and instead of just having the public's comments and the division, they actually took, at the Wildlife Board, after all the racks, they took the public's comments and made them their own. And I really appreciated that instead of having to go a whole nother year to do that. And I'm hearing Leslie tonight even say, you know what, we're hearing your concerns. And we're willing to do this. We'll make it a limited entry. And I think from hearing those public's concerns, I think that would be from the division's proposal, having that limited entry hunt for the 1 year. And I think whatever those numbers are, it's a one-year deal. I don't think you're going to kill all the bear off. You can set those numbers at what you want. But hearing what the public's saying, I think that would be a compromise.
If I could, just one comment. Looking at the presentation, I'd underline some things here. The division wants to increase harvest to help prevent human-bear conflicts and control nuisance and depredation bears, and I think that's what they're moving forward with, and I appreciate Darris's comments in that you have those safety valves already worked into the bear management plan that they can do that without over-harvesting or take it 1 year at a time, and I appreciate that. I think that's what should be done here with whatever motion we make. So I just make that comment.
Now I'm with Daryl. I don't know what to do. I get the problem with conflict with hounds getting into bait. Accidentally. I mean, hounds are running bear tracks, and a lot of times bear tracks are headed right to a bait station. So I get that, but I also don't like the fact that the houndsmen get such a big percent of the tags, and the bait hunters that now include a lot of rifle hunters are used to. People that didn't want to use a bow and arrow, they were going to hire houndsmen. Now they don't have to hire houndsmen. Now they're going to put in for a bait station tag. So now the odds of for those guys like myself that would like to shoot one with a bow and arrow over bait, odds are going to go sky high to ever draw one of those tags, especially with the breakdown in permits, because the hound hunters got a lot bigger portion than the bait hunters are going to get. So that's why I'm sitting where I'm sitting.
I can see that definitely happening, but I also believe a lot of those, when you make a big change, there's going to be modifications in the following years, and coming back in a year, I see some of those things being able to be modified.
And I can see those modifications too, but why don't they go make those modifications, come back to us with something a little better next year, or now that they've heard all the public comments, they're going to hear it. So this year, let's just bump tag numbers and stay with status quo on the seasons. That's kind of where I'm leaning.
Kevin, where we're saying that we want to prevent human and bear conflicts, having the summer hunt to me increases the bear human conflicts because we do have more people in the mountains and on the mountain and stuff, and baiting draws bears in, and people have food in their camps. It just seems like it's sort of setting us up for more bear human conflicts.
This is fun, huh?
This is a blast.
This is only the beginning.
Let's see where this goes. I'm going to make a motion to keep the hunting season strategy status quo and let the division set permit numbers for the existing seasons as set up prior to this year with up to a 50% increase. Essentially, follow up bear tags following the existing bear management plan to the level they feel needed on each unit.
You got that, Brandon? Okay. We have a second.
I'll second that.
Okay. Seconded by Carl Ivory.
And if I could put with that
just some clarification, the reason for that is to let the division then address the comments that have been made through the RAC meetings in order to zero in specifically what would be the best for season use changes for the next year. But that will still increase the harvest. That's why the second motion.
And one comment I would have to that, after having been to the big game rack last couple weeks ago, again, I said that the division did take what they got out of every rack, and they did take what they liked out of that and make a proposal, and I think it made it a lot easier for the Wildlife Board. So I think that they have strived to do that. So anyway, so we got a motion by Dara, seconded by Carl. All in favor? Okay, we have 5, 6. Okay, 6 in favor. Opposed?
Could you, in the microphone, could you name the people for
me? Yeah. Okay, again, all in favor. Darius, Chris, Carl, Tricia, Jeff, and Charlie. And opposed? Wayne, Todd, Daryl, and Sue.
Boy, you ended up voting with me again.
Yeah, I know.
So, okay. Motion passed. Wolf management plan.
Realized, or
we can amend that, can't we?
Well, I'd like to ask if we could.
We can have a second motion.
Separate motion.
I'd like to. I'll wait till we get everybody's attention. I'd like to make a second motion or an amendment to that, I guess is the way to put it, that we include that depredation in there for these watermelon guys and other crop producing guys for these bears, because there hasn't been nothing there before, and it is a bad problem, and they need a little help there.
So you're presenting that as an amendment to the motion?
That'd be fine.
Can we do that after a vote, or not?
Can we just do a probably have to do another?
So that was
another motion.
Just a separate motion.
So my question would be, the other parts of the plan, are they not accepted?
Correct.
Other than your dates? Because there was
That's
a lot of
I
things
understood.
In that plan. I assumed that...
I'm confused.
Yeah.
For clarification on my motion, I guess, my intent was to have season structure same as last year, with nothing new and different that was proposed this year, but with increased number of bear tags in within the existing season structure that is there now.
But so everything else would stay the same.
It, as presented by the DWR.
No.
No, I'm just saying last no year. Summer season or any of that.
Yeah.
No, right. But what about their dealing with the with the all
depredation.
Of the other issues, depredation?
I think we noncommittal. I mean, I don't care
one
way or the
other. Motion. I think that we should indeed agree with the depredation portion of this change. I think that that's a worthwhile part.
Okay,
we should do that.
So clarification, if we want to address that, it needs to be in a second motion, in a separate motion.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'd like to make a motion that we include the depredation on the crop damage.
And the black bear increase.
As suggested by the division.
Okay. So we have a motion made by Charlie to accept the crop damage rule as presented by the division. And seconded by Jeff Horrocks. Is there any questions on the motion? Is that okay to Leslie? Is that?
Yeah. So I just so I'm clear, you want us to go back to our season structure that we had the previous 3 years without the archery only bait only without the summer season and no. Do you want any weapon over bait?
No. I mean, we did.
You
we
wanted
did last
to revert to the previous 3 years.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's clear.
Yeah, that'll be done in this motion.
In this motion. Do we want to include the black bear orientation course in this?
Yeah.
That's
probably a good idea.
Yeah.
I'll make an amendment to that motion.
Okay. Now, just for clarification.
All over the board here.
Fire away.
There already is a bear orientation course. It's just that you're required to take it after you draw a tag instead of before you apply for a tag. So, I mean, that's the difference between last year's and this
year's. This year's.
I think that's fine. It's up to you bear hunters, whatever you guys think. You want to take your class before or after?
I just want them to take the class. I don't care when.
Well,
it would
Darren,
be.
What do you think?
It would be helpful for the division to have them
take
it before.
So you might as well just take it before.
I have no problem with them taking it when they apply, you know, because there's a lot of people that don't even know what's going on.
Yeah.
They all just want to kill a bear. So
well, I thought that's all it's required.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. Okay, well, let's just leave it. Then they have to take it before they get their tag.
Okay, so that's going to have to be in the motion that you make with your depredation.
My motion, yes. Well, actually,
we need to restate the motion for Brent.
Okay.
So what we're going to restate the motion.
No structure.
Okay.
So we need to start out with Darris's motion again, and then Charlie has one.
Well, problem is,
we don't need to do Darris's.
Yeah,
we
already got Darris.
Let's start.
It's already been both.
After that vote, which passed 7-4, and then Charlie's motion, which I have to
vote. To include the crop depredation section of that, as suggested by the DWR, as by the division.
Charlie, would you consider adding and the taking the orientation course prior to applying to that same motion? Because that's a portion of the new part that I excluded in my motion, just like the depredation bill.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to restate that. So Charlie made a motion, and it was to accept the crop depredation rule as presented by the division, and it was amended by Darris to also include the orientation course
prior to
application, as also presented by the division. Do we have a second on that motion? Seconded by Jeff Horrocks. All in favor, please hold your hands up. Unanimous? Okay. Unanimous, Brent.
Okay, thank you.
All right, wolf management.
Okay, this will be really short. Maybe. I broke it.
You are short.
Okay. I fit this region, though. I fit Wade and Boone. Okay. So I'm asking for a 5-year extension on our current wolf management plan. So that being said, we're not requesting any changes to the wording or anything else. Let me give you a little bit of background. Wolves are delisted in a small portion of northern Utah, which consists pretty much of parts of Cache, Rich, Morgan, and Summit County. Outside of that area, wolves are still protected by the Endangered Species Act, and management falls to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. State law directs our agency to prevent the establishment of wolves in any delisted areas of Utah until the entire state is delisted. If we do have wolves that occur, we do request the service to remove any wolves found in portions of Utah that are listed until the entire state is delisted. Currently, wolves are proposed for delisting range-wide. Unfortunately, because of legal issues, it keeps going back and forth, and that hasn't happened. Our plan here in Utah does not take effect until wolves are delisted statewide. The biological status of wolves in Utah, we have confirmed approximately 13 individual wolves over the past 10 years that have either gone through or been in Utah. Almost all have been in counties that border Wyoming or Idaho, with the exception of the one that made residence in Arizona recently. There's no evidence of breeding activity. And the last known wolf that we have in our state occurred in the Uintas this past fall. The last time that we located it using the radio collar was late September, early October. We have not been able to relocate that animal. We're not sure if either the radio collar failed or it continued going somewhere else. So this plan that I've brought tonight was passed by the Wildlife Board in 2005 for a 10-year period. It has never gone into effect. It did take quite a long time for us to negotiate, work through, and develop this plan. So without having to try and recreate all of those steps, we're just asking for a 5-year extension on this plan, which will expire the end of December. And based on the current legal and biological status, we anticipate that they'll be delisted, and we want to make sure we have a plan in place. That's it.
Thank you. Questions from the rack?
These just include these gray wolves, or are you including these red wolves too?
It's
all wolves.
It's all wolves.
The Uinta wolf, was it radio collared by us, or was it out of Wyoming or Idaho?
So it came from the Boundary Peak Pack, and it was radio collared by Idaho Fish and Game in August of 2013. The last time they heard it was that time, and they figured that the collar failed until we picked it up. We had a list of missing frequencies. We were able to identify that frequency, and the pictures of the wolf that we have match the ones that they had in Idaho. So we're pretty confident it was that animal. The collar was only for a year, so we're not sure if it just out and died or if it's gone on to other places.
Now that one of the northern wolves has moved to Arizona, has there been any discussion from the Fish and Wildlife Service on the Mexican wolf and the boundary? I know they were talking about portions of southeastern Utah maybe being Mexican wolf versus northern wolf.
Yeah, I know there have been discussions, and I know that it does create some issues with hybridization and things. I'm not sure where it's at right now at this point, though.
Just one question. The reason it hasn't been put into effect is because the wolf has not been delisted?
Correct.
Statewide. Okay.
Correct. And so we're just holding it in perpetuity.
Thank you. So So one of the things to for your question, Darris, is from the director's presentation last week, I think that was one of the major concerns with that wolf being on the North Rim. They've had a lot of discussions with Fish and Wildlife Service asking them to do something with that northern wolf for fear of that hybridization. But as of right now,
nothing's happened on that front.
Yeah.
So the wolf that's in Arizona, the radio collar that's on it is not working. There are pictures of it and the radio collar. They've tried to trap it, and they have not been successful catching the animal. And so I know they're trying to continue so that they can put a collar on it, but they haven't been successful.
So they know it's still there, basically.
Yeah, they've had additional sightings.
Are we still in questions or comments?
We're in questions.
Okay.
Questions from the audience? Comments from the audience? Okay. Comments from the rack.
I don't. No, I really don't think that this is a good plan, and I hope I didn't vote for it before.
Did I? I'm sure you didn't, Wayne.
I was probably medicated if I did. I'm opposed to renewing it. I don't really like it. I would not vote for it originally, and would not vote to renew it.
Other comments? Okay. Entertain a motion.
I make a motion. I accept it. Go with it.
Second.
Seconded by Charlie. I was going to say seconded by Wayne. But seconded by Charlie. Tracy. All in favor? Opposed. Okay, opposed by Wayne.
Sue. No. Oh, I thought your hand was up.
Okay.
I voted for it.
Okay. One opposed, Wayne.
Sorry. All right, thank you.
Kenny Johnson, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Admin Services Chief from Salt Lake City, and I will try to be brief with this last presentation. Wildlife Convention permits, we're making three really basic changes to this, but let me give you a little bit of history on the convention. This rule came about in 2005, was adopted through the RAC and board process. What it does provides up to 200 limited entry permits of various species to be issued at a convention held within the borders of Utah that has to attract at least 10,000 attendees and be run by a group or combination of groups that have a track record of enhancing wildlife and wildlife species in Utah. Permits are issued through a random draw process, $5 a hunt. The permits have been approved and contracted for 5 years at a time, and the Wildlife Board each year approves the actual permits that are offered through that convention. And these permits do come off the total of permits that are available to the public. So the current status is in 2016, the current contract will expire. That will complete our second 5-year term or contract for the convention expo permits. The contract was actually amended in 2013 to do a couple of things. One, to specify that the contractor retained only the same part of the application fee that we allow our bucks and bulls contractor to retain, and to do a few other things, audit more closely the funds and those kinds of things. And so it's currently we're operating under that amendment now. And then what that did is identified the remaining funds and specified those for projects to be used by approval of the division director in writing. And then the way it works, those funds must be committed or expended on approved projects by September 1st, 2 years after they're collected. So they have a couple of years to make sure those funds are used on the ground for projects that the division approves. So the proposed changes, again, three of them. What we want to do with this first one is just rename the rule from the word convention to the word expo. And really, this just does a couple of things. It kind of separates the identity of conservation and convention, which are easily kind of intertwined and confused often. So we think that'll remove some of that public confusion. The effect of that is we refer to convention permits in seven other rules. And so as a housekeeping item, we'd have to go into these seven rules and also change the word convention to expo. And so I won't read all of those, but we will make those changes if this proposal passes. The second one is, I mentioned earlier, we're under an amendment of the contract to kind of more closely monitor that $5 application money. The second one, we just want to put that into the actual rule. So take it from an amendment to part of the rule. And I'm sorry, I jumped ahead one. This slide will allow the conservation organization who has the contract an opportunity to apply for a five-year extension pending board approval and mutual agreement of the division. So the intent here, that's that last bullet point, this is only for contracts awarded after 2016. So the current contract will expire. There will be a new RFP process. It'll go out for open bid. And then this piece of the rule specifically will apply 5 years later. They could apply for an extension, just a one-time five-year extension. Sorry, and then this one is the one I skipped to. We wanted to formalize that piece of the amendment to kind of separate the revenue. And so what we're proposing after meeting and talking with the groups is $3.50 to be retained by the contractor for their use, and $1.50 specified in rule for the division projects that are approved by the director. What this does, it kind of just standardizes that moving into the future. We've had that connected to our draw contract, that last dash, and the two are just night and day. They don't compare. They're apples and oranges, and so we think this is a fair way to separate that revenue. And that is all I have. Thanks.
Any questions from the rack?
Got a couple questions. In the language, it says up to 200 permits. Have there ever been less than 200?
No.
What scenario would lead to there being less?
It would take adjustments to the total number of permits. So less being available overall would probably drive those down.
Since they come out of the general draw, you mean?
Yes.
Okay. Out of the 350 that they retain, do they pay someone to run the draw out of that 350, or is that from the other 150?
They, and maybe we can have some of them speak to it, but they cover a lot of the costs of the expo in running that draw with that money.
With the 350.
It's for their use for that purpose. So that would probably be a big chunk of that.
Okay.
Of that 350, are they having to tell us how much of that money is going into conservation? I hear the word conservation. I'd like to know that money is going into conservation. And I understand. I am a part of a conservation organization, but the administrative cost is really clearly defined in our annual reports is pretty much around 10%. So I'd like to know that 10% of that 350 is going to into their administrative cost, and the rest is going into conservation. And it worries me if it's not. And I think
worried.
Huh?
Be worried.
Okay, I am worried. I'm greatly worried because I'll get it when we get into comments, I'll stop. But I'd like to know if we know where that 350 goes. And if not, I think that line needs to be delineated.
We don't audit the 350. It allows them the flexibility to host the expo and to run their organizations. And, you know, frankly, the division is very supportive of all of our conservation partners. Anybody that shares that mission to protect wildlife, enhance environment, to recruit, retain, anything to continue to promote our heritage and our mission, you know, we think is good. And that's the cost benefit to us. So when we look at the cost versus the benefit derived from it, we're okay with that. We do audit the $1.50. We audit the $3.50, so we know it's kept separate. We know what the total is, but we don't itemize it.
Can you tell me last year's number? Because I read on the Mule Deer Foundation today, I tried to do a little bit of quick research, that they made I got the number $12 million. I don't know if that $12 million was just the Mule Deer Foundation's take, if it was the overall $5. Can you give me a number?
No, so application fees, it's $5 per application. There were just over 200,000 applications. So it was just over $1 million.
Okay.
So
I don't know where that, okay, so that was wrong.
So yeah, so the 12 must have been.
Yeah, okay. They have other sources, you know, revenue, the entrance fees and right. Those type of things.
Yeah.
Tricia, just the $1.50 is what is for the projects.
Yes.
That's what the division is. The $3.50, you don't know where it goes.
Right.
So that's if that makes that helps you.
Yeah.
Basically.
One question. You talked about the process and a little bit, but generally, how many bidders are there when you open it up for the bid process?
You know, that's a fair question. I wasn't involved in the first two RFPs, so I don't, off the top of my head, know how many people put in for it. We know there's some interest, and probably will be multiple bids next time, but I don't know what that number would be.
And is it limited to conservation groups or user groups?
30%.
I guess, or individuals can make the bid, too.
It's essentially groups that help us conserve wildlife. So.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some more technical language in the rule, but it's essentially groups.
Okay.
Are they
nonprofit?
They have to be nonprofit. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So Kenny, another question here. Doing some rudimentary math here. If we've got 200,000 applicants, $5, about $1 million. The division's take is 30%. $1.50 out of the five, right, is 30%. So that's 300,000. Would we be better served, would the division be better served using those as conservation tags? Would you generate more revenue for the division that way?
That's a fair question. It's something we could probably do run an analysis of and see. You know, we're essentially leveraging.
you give away how many Henry tags at the expo? I know those are going for 100 grand. So,
I'll speak a little of that. One of the reasons why I think the public has voted for it, the reason it is because those are public tags. They go to the public. But I think if you take those away and put them as conservation tags,
well, the public can still buy them. They can still go buy them.
Well, yeah, but not you. Not
Kevin, you work for the Forest Service.
Right. So I think that support would quickly go away.
But what if they went back into the draw? Then public...
Then wouldn't be conservation.
Well, no, but the public gets a chance at them.
They do now.
Well, kind of.
Well.
I mean, it's all a chance. Talking about the 200 tags. Right now, they've got to wait until 10, so that's 200 tags.
To answer Todd's question, if they went back to the public draw, you wouldn't make anywhere near $300,000 selling 200 tags.
Right.
It's about $50,000 worth of face value on those 200 tags. So we're taking that leverage.
Just the tag price is about $50,000.
Correct.
So,
okay. So it's an interesting concept, but yeah.
In that bidders, what's the word I'm searching for? During that bidders time, are you guys evaluating those nonprofits closely? I tried to do a little bit of evaluation of those two organizations today, and I could get the financials from the Mule Deer Foundation. Their last annual report on their website was from 2008, and so it was hard for me to to wade through their tax return. The Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, I had a great deal of trouble. Every financial I attempted to pull up said, oops, website not. The rest of their website was working fine. Any financials that I attempted or pulling up an annual report or conservation where their money went said, oops, this site is not working at this time. And so I just want to know that during that bidders conference that there's a deep evaluation that those organizations are truly doing the best possible, you know, the best they possibly can with our money. Because in the end, wildlife is held in public trust. And so it is our money. It's our resource.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important that we're not just feeding a beast, that we're taking care of, you know, our wildlife first. And you hope that you're bidding to the best possible organization where their funds are transparent and their funds are going into conservation.
Yeah, we absolutely look at that. Okay. And scrutinize it. And part of it is, you know, it's to look and see who can meet the purpose of this rule, which is to kind of create excitement for conservation. And we look and see who does that. And then part of the RFP is to hear proposals of kind of their business model, how they expect it to work. So that does get scrutinized and looked at close.
I hope so.
Questions?
Yeah, I just have one more with the extension of the 5 years. It's to, I guess that puts it back onto the Wildlife Board to determine if that's going to happen or not.
Correct. The division, the Wildlife Board, and the group. So it's a kind of a three-way check at the end of the 5 years.
And are they looking at specifics of if it's working the best or not working, or why the extension, I guess?
I think so. It minimizes some of the risks, and so it helps long-term planning, and you'll hear probably a little bit of that in the comment period later. But yeah, if there's a good thing going, I guess it gives them a chance to continue and keep it going.
Okay.
You said any of the either the group, the division, or the board can nix the extension,
mm-hmm.
and any of those three, the group decides he doesn't want to do it anymore. The division can say, we don't want this anymore, but if the Wildlife Board wants it, how do the division trumps the Wildlife Board?
That's a good question. I think we wrote it in there as consensus. It had to be approved by all three.
All three.
Yeah.
Questions from the audience?
Troy Justinson, Sportsman, Fish and Wildlife. Kenny, how much do you pay Fallon Nevada every year to process your application fees?
That contract is about $1.5 million.
Of that $1.5 million, how much comes back into Utah Wildlife for projects?
None of that.
None of it. Okay. On that $1.5 million, how many jobs does that bring to the state of Utah?
That's a good question. Depends on how you slice. So we've got contract
people on the ground in the state of Utah working.
We've got a lot of people that work with that contract here in the division.
Okay. Within the division. But as far as a private sector, how many people does it provide jobs for?
None in Utah.
None in Utah. What economic value does it bring to, say, Salt Lake County by having the draw there?
Depends on how philosophical you want to get. It's a
tourism, dollars spent in hotels, food.
Yeah, no benefits there.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions from the audience? Okay, I'd entertain comments. Please bring up your comment card.
Well, we're waiting for those comment cards, Kenny. What out of that $1.5 million you're paying Nevada, how many applications are being processed for that?
We continue to grow that one, and we're just about $500,000 applications a year. But that contract, again, it's apples and oranges. They have a long list of other things. It's a performance-based contract, and I renegotiate the fees every year, trying to save the state as much money as we can. And so, you know, it's a cost we have that provides a skill set that that if we had to recreate in-house would probably cost us 3 or 4 or 5 times that much money. So it, you know, it's a niche they have. It actually just opened for RFP this fall, and nationwide it's just kind of a shrinking market. We had one other bid for that contract, and they just didn't have the technical expertise to pull it off. And so it's an interesting market.
Troy Justison.
Troy Justison, Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife. I think the key point to remember in this is we're talking about an application fee. It's no different what we charge, the $5 fee or the $10 fee that goes to file in Nevada. Those funds, you know, it's a little bit misleading when you see on there that says it's $3.50 to overhead. Speaking on behalf of Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife, I can tell each one of you that 100% of that goes back into conservation. Now, not 100% may not go back into projects, but it goes into conservation. All our money stays within the state of Utah. All our money is spent in preserving and enhancing wildlife and the hunting heritage in the state of Utah. The other key thing to remember, too, is what it brings to the state. As John's going to talk a little bit later, it's a huge economic impact that, you know, with tourism, food, or whatever that comes into Salt Lake to attend this expo. You ask where the dollars go. I think you can talk to any major land agency within here, the BLM, the Forest Service, the Grand Staircase, and ask them, when there's a big project come up, who steps forward? I guarantee you that you will see by our track record what we've done with the monies. We've done a lot in San Juan County. You guys got a huge problem with deer being hit between Monticello and Blanding. All right, we stepped up with dollars to match DOTs to look at putting underpasses to prevent that. We also stepped up and paid $12,000 to put signs to, you know, warn motorists to slow down. We also spent about $30,000 in cleaning about 22 catchments out on Black Mesa that not only benefit wildlife, but benefit livestock owners as well. I guess my point is this, is yes, it's a business. You have to have money to run a business. But I know for a fact that, you know, our main drive in raising this money is we can do more things in people's backyards. We spent over $180,000 in putting ringneck pheasants out for the youth to hunt. We've spent over close to $200,000 on transplanting mule deer. So if you're going to accuse us of one thing, it's one thing for sure. We spent this money in our backyard to enhance the opportunity for those of us who enjoy the outdoors. Thank you. By the way, we support the division's recommendations. And even if it comes the time when they award it to another group, we support those changes as well. If it's RMEF that has it, if it's NWTF, these are changes that allow them to be effective and also to plan forward. So it's not just because right now we currently have the bid with the Mueller Foundation. And the thing to remind, too, is RMEF, NWTF, and Wild Sheep were all invited to participate in the beginning, and they chose to withdraw. Thank you.
Ed Louder. Following him will be Kim McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ben Louder, representing the Utah Bones Association. We attend this expo every year. We have a booth at this expo every year. We believe that it's a great event held here in Utah. It draws, as Troy said, draws tourism here, draws hunters from around the country here. We believe that the current organizations that are doing that are putting on the expo are doing a great job. We recognize what they're putting on the ground here in the state, and we appreciate that. And as such, we support the recommendations as presented. Thank you.
Kim McFarland. I'm here mostly representing myself, but I also gave a letter from the United Wildlife Cooperative speaking to this. First of all, I have immensely enjoyed the expo, how it's put on, and as a recipient of the Sportsman's Deer Tag in 2009, having displayed that in the expo, my brother having displayed things in the expo, I think it is a great, an awesome opportunity for the state of Utah. You know, I have three concerns. The first is that the money that is raised from the expo, you know, as a sportsman, I would like to see that that is assured that the majority of that money goes towards conservation projects, and that the majority of the funds from those $5 tags should be specified for conservation projects. The second concern is accountability and transparency of those funds from the expo permit. While the rules read for the division to be able to audit those, I think that it's important that that be a public audit, that those numbers are available, that it shows sportsmen like me where that money is being spent, how it's being spent, and the benefit that we are providing to the state of Utah. Because I think there is some benefit. I just think it's hard to quantify from looking at the resources available where that is, and that when the board or the division audits those funds, that should be promoted and demonstrated to the sportsmen. I also believe that the division and wildlife board should set some expectations on this 5-year renewal process that says that these are the goals that we expect you to have in order to have the 5-year renewal project and the renewal of the project, and that that not be a guarantee that it will be renewed if they don't meet those goals, that it will be required that that's not acceptable if they're not achieving the goals that's been laid out. I also think that there should be an audit, an independent audit of those funds, say in the fourth year, that would allow the division to look at those organizations and say, there has been an independent eye look at these, and they are spending the money the way that they say that they're spending the money, and it is benefiting the conservation projects and wildlife in the state of Utah. So I'd propose that there be a 50-50 split instead of the $3.50 and $1.50, and that there be some accountability and transparency in their audits, and those be made available publicly. Thank you.
John Larson.
It's good to be with you tonight. My name is John Larson, speaking on behalf from Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, but speaking on behalf of the Hunt Expo and its partners. As Troy indicated, we do endorse the division's plan as recommended and presented tonight. And in addition to that, I'd like to take just a couple minutes and attempt to educate the group here just a little bit on a couple things that the Expo does for the state of Utah. And I'll start with from a financial perspective. In 2009, we partnered with the Mueller Foundation and the University of Utah to conduct the Bieber Report, which is the Bureau of Economic Business and Research, and we found the Expo generated $8.5 million worth of revenue streaming into the state through multiple avenues or multiple channels, some of which have already been mentioned tonight: tourism, entertainment, hotels, food, restaurant, all that stuff. It's 4 years later. We anticipate that number now to look more like between $10 and $11 million. That's a big win for Utah's local economy. It's a great deal for us. Secondly, and more importantly, is what the Expo does for Utah's wildlife, however, and that's really what we're here tonight to discuss. And I'll give you a couple examples here. The last 3 years, we've partnered with the division in releasing, Troy mentioned, close to 36,000 ringneck pheasants across the state of Utah to a tune of close to $180,000. Those funds primarily were set forth by Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. We did that for a couple reasons. First, to get kids off the couch with dad into the field again. Secondly, to generate some excitement among the general public to hunt pheasants again after a two-decade decline in poor pheasant habitat and lousy hunting conditions. Really, zero birds. And we've done that. And that we're really seeing the fruits of our labor now. This has been a great pheasant hunt this year. Another example would be in 2013, we partnered with Brigham Young University and the division again in the first ever mule deer translocation project. Troy alluded to that as well, moving 300 mule deer off of the Parowan Front and Antelope Island to the Pavant and Oak Creek units where there's better winter range, and those deer have a fighting chance to survive, also bolstering the herd, future herd of Utah. As a result of that, you now have New Mexico, places like New Mexico and British Columbia stepping in, literally using our model for their transplant projects. So we are now literally modeling the way for better big game management on a go-forward basis across the country. Those are just two examples. Now what I want to do is shift gears for a minute, and I'd ask you to put your business cap on just for a minute with me, if you would, and take a look at the division's proposal from a business perspective. Here's what I tell you. If you think about it, if you have any business sense, you'll realize that your relationships you build in business are built on trust, much like your personal relationships, and those relationships take time to foster. Once you define where you're going with your partner, you're continuously refining that all the time. You're massaging those relationships all the time. And so, an example, I've been with SFW for 2 months, and in that 60 days, I've sat in two joint meetings between SFW and the Mule Deer Foundation as we prepare for the expo, which is right around the corner. I'm amazed at the amount of massaging we're still doing with our vendor partners at the expo 9 years later, not five, 9 years later, just to get them to feel good. These are major vendors that have been with us since day one, and we're still massaging those relationships. So to think you can turn around and just hand that expo over every 5 years to a new contractor, regardless of who the contractor is, it should go to the best person for the job. But to think you can turn it over turnkey and there won't be any risk to what we've built for the state's economy already and the future of our wildlife through the funds we raise there, there's risk there, great risk. Secondly, to the $5 application fee, here's what I would tell you. There is cost to running an expo. By the raise of hands, who in the room has been to the expo? Just raise your hands, please. Thank you for your participation. If you've been to it, you know that's an enormous undertaking. That is a major show. It's a big show. It's a marquee show of the West. In my opinion, it's right here in our backyard. We don't have to go to Reno, Nevada, or Las Vegas, Nevada. It's a show right here for us to enjoy. There's a cost to make that happen. You have to understand that. It's a big cost. It's a big show to do. I can attest to that. And with those fees, not only do we pay for the show, but that also goes back to the ground. So those two examples I shared with you in the beginning, those were paid for by those $5 entry fee tickets, those prices. That money goes back to the ground in Utah. That's our entire mission, is to ensure the sustainability of wildlife in Utah for our future generations. And so looking at the division's plan in closing here, I would just simply say I think it's a great plan. I think it will only enhance and develop our economy and our future wildlife in the state for years to come. Thank you.
Thanks, John. And any other comments from the audience? Okay, with that, I'll entertain comments from the RAC.
I want to make a comment, and directly to Troy, I wasn't making an accusation. I just would highly recommend that you guys update your website and make sure that your financials are up and available to everybody. And it's really good to just have annual reports that are really easily waded through. I would state that. The Elk Foundation does a really good job of just putting an annual report. It's not only nationwide, but state. They also do it for the state. And then it delineates their specific projects for that state. It's PR, and it's great. It's the way to go. It should be really transparent. It was making no accusations. I was simply giving a recommendation. If you are truly a 501c3, those financials should be available. You should not go to, and I've gone to that website multiple times and come up with that same response, that page is not available. And it has to be. We're doing comments from the RAC right now. I would also state, when you look at, for example, and I just pulled up two today, just the Elk Foundation, the Mule Deer Foundation, 10% of their revenue goes to administrative costs or fundraising, 10%. And so I would ask that of that $350, we allow 10% to go to administration. And I think that that's an easy number to come up with. And we could look at all the organizations and come up with their average, but I looked at two of the bigger big game organizations, and that was the number that I came up with. Again, I have a job, so it's hard for me to spend a huge amount of time. I adamantly oppose the five-year renewal. I think that it's okay for those organizations to go back to the bidders table and to show that they're the best organization for the job. And I don't think that's asking too much. And I do appreciate delineating the word conservation from expo, because I think that's actually been muddy water for a long time, and it needs to be delineated. Is that a lot? And then I'll shut up.
That was very good.
I'm in complete agreement with Tricia. I do believe that transparency is incredibly important. Myself personally, I'm not trying to say that the expo's not important. I think it's a huge asset to the state. I think it's a great thing. It's great for people that hunt, and it's an awesome thing for us to have, and it does bring a lot of money into the state. I think the concern is the transparency of where the 350 goes, and the administrative costs, and I agree we should be able to see that. We should be able to pull it up and see it at any time.
Okay, I gotta say something. I don't know what the deal is with me. I don't really have any opposed of this thing, but I have to comment a little bit on the SFW's things, what they contribute to and things. They do a wonderful job as far as putting money on the ground. I don't have any complaints with that at all, and if they contributed on the highway thing between Monticello and Blanding, that's awesome, because we've got a serious problem there. That's a bad, bad deal. The deer go back and forth. I don't care if it's winter, summer. It's just a bad, bad problem. So that's great. I guess where I get, and I've had this conversation with Don Pay for forever. I don't know, Don, is Don still ahead of everything there? Or?
He's not.
Okay. Well, anyway, we're going to ancient history here, I guess. But as far as putting money out, SFW can do a lot more than I can in the name of wildlife. Whereas if I put in a project for livestock, especially with any federal agency, it's out the window. It doesn't even get a try. So I'm grateful for SFW and some of the things that they can do, because they can get some of these water projects or reseedings or whatever you want to call it. It's in the name of wildlife. I still think it's crap, because we should be able to do those projects, and we have been able to do them in the past. And if it wasn't for the guys who did it in the early 30s on to the mid-80s, we wouldn't have what we've got now. But I'm grateful that there is still some avenue where we can go back and redo those chainings and those sort of things, rebuild those ponds. A lot of those ponds that were built on my place were built with a Fresno plow. If you ever know what that is, that's very labor-intensive. But I just don't want to let us diminish or what's happened before us, because we all stand on the shoulders of people who have gone before us.
I'll speak up a little bit to the convention. I can't speak to the financials and what's on the internet, but I can speak from an agency standpoint where a lot of these dollars come from, because I have the opportunity to put a lot of those dollars on the ground. So I can speak to Mule Deer Foundation and Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife to contributing a tremendous amount of money in Utah in habitat work. And so I, from an agency standpoint, can say a lot of that money's going on the ground.
I have no doubt about that. All I'm asking is that we ensure that as much as possible goes on to the ground. And I don't think that's asking too much, because, again, I'll just state that it's our resource that we've all contributed to. And so we want to know that that resource is generating money for itself.
I think it's important. I agree with the gentleman that talked about transparency and public audit. I do want to see most of the money going to projects, but I don't want to tie the hands or direct other nonprofits. If we did have a public audit and it was transparent, and then we had a renewal process, that would be some information to help us further understand whether their permits will be renewed or not. So I guess I'll let discussion happen or I can make a motion.
Do it.
Good?
Do it.
Everybody ready? So I make a motion to adopt, I don't even know what we're talking about, the rule that we're talking about, whatever number it is.
R657-55.
R657-55. With the addition that there will be a public audit that will be available and transparent to all that request it.
Okay. Question on that motion. Is that not a requirement already of all 501c3s?
It is. It would have to be.
Not necessarily. So we're part of a 501c3 and we don't have to make our product public.
Okay. Kenny, can you speak to, is any of the audit made public?
Yeah. Excuse me. My office oversees the audit. Part of the amendment we made to the contract was to audit. And so my staff actually performs an internal audit. We look at everything top to bottom. We look at applications. We look at fairness. We look at code. We look at databases. We look at the finances. So we do that. I don't know that we're publishing it on the web, but I don't know why we couldn't. I could make that available.
Thank you. Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Charlie Tracy. All in favor? Okay, I'm going to Darris, Carl, Sue, Daryl, and Jeff.
Charlie.
Okay, and Charlie.
I'm sorry, I was saying it in my head.
Opposed, just so. Okay, Chris, Trish, Todd, Wayne.
Motion passes.
Okay. I voted twice with Wayne tonight. What's going on?
Thank you. And with that, we're going to give some time to for a Habitat presentation, real quick.
Hopefully this is a little funner than.
It's all fun.
It's fun. It's fun.
Ooh, getting funner than this.
Okay. Can you even hear me? Okay, we're just going to talk about some habitat projects that have happened in the southeastern region. This is just an overview of what has happened from the beginning of UPCD and WRI in around the fiscal year of 2005 until 14. You can see that there's been a lot of money spent, a lot of acres treated, and a lot of projects that have been done. This is what has been proposed for fiscal year 2015, so that's the fiscal year we're currently in. You can see there's been a lot of money allocated to just this region, and there's been a lot of acres proposed to be treated. Most of these projects are underway or are finished. There are some that haven't been finished yet, so yeah, there's a lot of work to be done and a lot of work that has been done. So one project that hasn't been started yet but is in the process, it's going to start soon, is the South Brook Cliffs Phase 2, which is in the Floyd Wash area, just down the road here. It's going to be a mixture of lop and scatter and bull hog. You can see that it's a fairly sizable project, and hopefully we can get it done soon. The helper bench is chaining. We did, I had a video in the black box, but it doesn't look like the video is going to play. Anyhow, it was 308 acres in near the town of Helper, of pinyon juniper that was chained. It was aerial seeded. The chaining went one direction, we aerial seeded, and then the chaining came back the other direction. You do that because a lot of times the trees will still be rooted after the one pass. So you put the seed on the ground, bring it back over, and you get a really nice seed bed for your seed, and then we hope for moisture. You can see in the bottom right-hand corner, that's taken from an airplane as somebody was flying over and snapped a shot for me. So it was kind of cool. In Beef Basin, there was 11,000 seedlings that were hand-planted. You can see that, you know, we have this little mechanism that has been designed to allow somebody to sit in the seat as it digs a trench. They drop the sagebrush seedling in, and the wheels pack it back in, and you have a sagebrush planted. We also did that near out in Monticello, kind of out in the wheat fields in Gunnison sage grouse country. I can't remember exactly how many seedlings were done there, but when I went back this summer, quite a few of those were still alive, so we got some rains, and good things happened there. Along other part of the Beef Basin project was there was an aerial spray of plateau because there's a lot of cheatgrass. You can see it's pretty barren. There's not a whole lot of sage. A lot of that has been lost, and it's competing with cheatgrass. So we sprayed with plateau and then came in with the rangeland drill and drilled in the seed to get it at the appropriate depth. And then hopefully, you know, as all of these, hopefully we get moisture. This one was completely a video. I tested it on somebody else's computer too before, and it worked then, so I'm not really sure what's going on. This was done on the Henry Mountains. It was a project that was done in pinyon juniper probably 3 or 4 years ago. The seed did not come in on that original project, so what this was a reseeding with a chain harrow. A chain harrow is just drug behind a bulldozer. It has a header bar and a loop of chain, and the chain rolls and prepares your soils so you can get a good seed bed. This one's been kind of my baby, so of course you have to hear about this one. We've been working on this for a few years now. What we're doing is going in with a bulldozer, pushing out aspen that has heavily encroached conifer in it to allow the aspen to regenerate. You can see in the picture on the right-hand side where you have bare soil. The project has happened recently. The stuff behind it is from the year before. You see we're getting great aspen response. It's been pretty cool. The picture in the middle, it was an email that was sent to me this fall. That gentleman and his son were up there hunting. The kid harvested that buck. He'd had such a great time. They harvested it within one of these areas where we had treated, and they were ecstatic. They thought it was great. You know, they said over the past few years their experience has been really great up there, and they're really happy with what we're doing, and they'd like to see more of it.
Quick question. Just which cold spring is that?
That is in Carbon. Yeah, all of these cottonwood and yeah, that's in Carbon County. That's on the west or on the Tavaputs, above East Carbon.
Yeah,
that's on the Cold Spring Wildlife Management Area. This is the Swayze's Wildlife Project. This is done on the Forest Service near Joe's Valley. This has been going on for years and years, it seems like, and just good things keep happening. They're going in with the bull hog there. It mulches the trees to pretty much nothing. You can see the piles that set there. There was a really cool video that shows what it actually looks like when they're doing that. This has allowed great response of the grasses and forbs. They're also mulching the shrubs to, you know, a more usable height for animals. And the leader growth response has been amazing on those shrubs, so it's providing a lot more forage for animals in that area. That 850 is what was proposed this year, but total project acres, I don't know, but it's a lot. It's very sizable.
I think it's close to about 15,000.
Yeah, okay. Mustang Mesa is in San Juan County. As anyone that's familiar with San Juan County, there's a lot of archaeological stuff there. So this project was seeded, and then they had a lop and scatter crew come in. And then the idea was to have cattle go in immediately after and try to, you know, make the seed bed for the soil. So this one's going to be really interesting to see what happens. And that's it.
Thank you, Cole. Questions from the rack?
What type of monitoring do you do after a habitat improvement project?
There can be a lot of different monitoring. Probably one of the most common is putting in photo points before you get, you know, you establish a site, put in some sort of marker, take photos, you know, get a compass direction so that you can mark this exact spot or have some, you know, feature out there that will be consistent throughout time. Then you can take your photo, go back each year and monitor to see. We also have the range train crew that comes in on certain projects. They do a really intensive monitoring thing. I can't remember all the methods that they do. That data is all on the website, so you can pull that up and see how projects are changing over time.
One thought to that too is these dollars are very competitive to get those now, and one of the ranking tools is monitoring, and so that's really a high priority now. I want to say it's even 10 points, which is so. Project leads are really having to put quite a bit of monitoring in there to even compete.
Yep. Yeah, that's accurate.
Other questions? Questions from the audience?
Mike King, representing USU Eastern. I just wanted to let everybody know how much help the division, particularly in the Southeast region, has been to our wildlife science program at USU Eastern and Price, and Nicole and Daniel and Chris and others are examples of that. They've all come to my various courses that we teach, and in particular this fall we taught a wildlife techniques class, and we were able to get right out in the middle of that helper bench chaining, which was probably the highlight of the course for a lot of these students who were in the class. So we got to get up and kick the chain and watch the dust fly and watch how those big chains can tear up a pinyon juniper tree in just a very short time. But anyway, I just wanted to express appreciation for all of you, and we've also had good support from the Forest Service and BLM and NRCS too. But anyway, Nicole was gracious enough to let us come out and sit in the middle and watch what was going on. So thank you.
Thanks, Mike. And also appreciate that support from the Wildlife Board. Any other comments from the audience? Comments from the rack? Okay. I do want to say really, really appreciate the attendance tonight. If for any reason you see in the future that there's going to be a conflict with your attendance, please get with Chris or Brent. But here in the near future, we're going to be working very closely. Two things. One is that the second year cycle, so there'll be some going off new applications, but it's a good time that if for some reason
attendance is going to be a problem, get with them because they can, during that cycle, get new applicants. So, but again, thanks for your attendance.
I should excuse Blair Eastman tonight. He called. He's in Texas receiving some award from George Bush. Yeah. Next time you see him, ask him about it.
Okay. Thank you.